Hello and welcome to Revision Media, revisionmedia.org, I should say, probably. Paul Stevenson, and this is Thursday, the 6th of February, 2020. January has disappeared in the blink of an eye. I think time does just seem to get faster as you get older, which is concerning and a little depressing. But anyway, glad to be with you folks live here from London and England. Wherever you are around the world, welcome to the show. It's through till 10 till 11 p.m. here in London, where I am. That is, what, 5 till 6 Eastern time, and I believe somewhere along the lines of 1 p.m. to 2 p.m. Pacific time. Wherever you are around the world, I hope I find you well. Do support Revision Media before I forget. We are 100% listener-supported. We're up against 24-hour lying propaganda networks and their agendas to cause you as much harm as possible, stoke up as much tensions as possible, social engineer degeneracy, and as much damage as they can possibly do. I mean, you see it over here so strikingly when, you know, the combination of mass immigration coupled with the media constantly interviewing people about their victimhood status as black people or brown people or whatever else. I mean, it doesn't exactly help. You know, if you're living in a multicultural town like London, a city like London, and you happen to be working with a black fella or a black woman or a brown woman or whatever, and this sort of stuff is on the radio, it immediately causes tension, I imagine. But as the media is owned by a certain clique of people known as the Jews, and I don't know what else to call them. They call themselves the Jews. So the Bible refers to them as the Jews, even though it makes a distinction between those Jews who were, you know, the original followers of Jesus Christ. There seems to be this other corporate term for, and it usually comes up, it comes up a lot anyway in the context of for fear of the Jews. And isn't our culture today largely engineered through fear and intimidation? So it's no surprise that we're talking about the same type of mindset. Certainly, I wouldn't say they're the same type of people in terms of their blood, but this type of, I think some of them are, but the ideology is handed down by Talmudic ideologies and all the rest of it to subjugate all other people. And communism, of course, came from Karl Marx and what they failed to do culturally, or what they failed to do with traditional communism. They certainly have had tremendous success doing it culturally, which is today most commonly known as political correctness. I'm sure we're all aware of this woke term, which is getting increasingly used at the minute, which is basically political correctness on steroids. You must be offended by everything. You must complain about everything. You must be a victim of the slightest thing. I even saw, it's staggering. I even saw on Piers Morgan's Today ITV news show that he does, where somebody comes in now and thinks it's offensive to be calling our animals pets. They want to change the name from pets to, I forget, to something else. I mean, this is how ridiculous it's got. I mean, it's just staggering. What do these people do? They just sit around all day thinking about what else could we moan about? Who else is a victim now? So the pets are apparently a victim because it sort of implies and denotes that we're the ownership of the pets. Last time I checked, that's exactly what we do with pets. We own them. Now, this is a problem, apparently, for the particular group that this young lady represented on Piers Morgan's show, Good Morning Britain, it's called. Yeah, Good Morning Britain. Well, you know, let's get you depressed as possible with the latest abomination. It's just, it literally, it's staggering. I'm not exaggerating. They want to get rid of, this particular group want to get rid of pets. You know, they want to get rid of gender, and they want to blur the gender gap as well, of course. And I think it's all one of the big stores over here, John Lewis, is now... it's removing, you know, gender labels from its clothes and everything else. So I will add John Lewis to a long list of places I won't spend my money in. And people should vote with their feet like that. If you want to play that game, you want to take the risk with your business and start playing politics with your business, then you better make sure that you've got the public on your side. They did a poll after that. And it was like 85% said they disagreed with it and 50% said they agreed with it. So doesn't sound like it's too good for business, John Lewis, when you've got 85% of a British poll said they essentially thought it was ridiculous that we should now remove labels on clothes because they stereotype genders. I mean, God forbid. I mean, this is a great irony, isn't it, of all these, this egalitarian stuff. On one hand, they want diversity.
On the other hand, they want us to all be the same. They don't even want gender. Let's not even make the unequivocal distinction between men and women. But they love diversity. Europe was one of the most diverse continents on the planet. There's a huge difference between Italy and Germany, or between Hungary and Ireland. We have enough diversity here in this in Europe, and they have to just flood the place with third world immigrants who don't share our values, to put it mildly, in most cases, and then talk about how diversity is our strength. Diversity is not a strength. This is why you have nations form in the first place. Nations form because in an organic evolution of similarities for the most part, ethnic similarity, cultural similarity, attitudes, religion, of course, and boundaries are put around that nation. This is why you have the distinction between the nations. And of course, the globalists and the Jew hasn't had a nation for so long and has been expelled from so many of them for his subjugation, or sorry, the subversion of the culture, and which he's still doing today, is domination of the banking and finances, financial systems and the media and all the rest of it. We have a situation where they don't like the nation because the nation is a threat to him, because the nations over history have gotten rid of him because he is a threat to the nation. So globalism likes to get rid of the nation state, much like the EU is a threat to the sovereignty of all nations, and in no small part diminishes sovereignty of the nations, and has them all under one umbrella, which they can control. But anyway, the point is nations do form organically over a period of time, and that's how they form, because of what's similar. And people gravitate towards what's similar. It just makes sense. I mean, this whole cultural Marxist thing, it's just this woke thing, and it really has got to the point of ridiculousness now. I mean, you literally don't know what you're going to be hearing next. But lo and behold, we had this thing on the news earlier. I mean, I don't know why I'm even surprised anymore, but who would think of it, that it's offensive, or not even offensive, they were just arguing that, you know, animals are real, you know, living things within their own right, and it's kind of, I don't know, they're not content with this idea that we call them pets. I mean, these people got better things to do, like that, you know, like the woman on there promoting this BS, like going keeping a home and looking after your family, having some children. Here's a white woman, of course, you're typical middle class virtue signaler who's got nothing better to think about, and how they can change the world for good, and that's what they come up with. Utter fools, morons. Go home, find a husband, have some children, bring up a home, and teach them some sense. Anyway, I was listening to Peter Hitchens earlier, and I'm going to play some of Peter Hitchens. I mean, I don't agree with everything what Peter Hitchens says, but I agree with a lot of it. And I think he's a journalist. He has been for years. He came out of a Trotskyite background, like many of his generation. And you know, in his younger years, he was a revolutionary, a Trotskyite. And then he came out of that, obviously, when he grew up and had some sense. And since then, he's been very much an apologist for, you know, for traditional values and Christianity. Well, I mean, I wouldn't agree with him everything in Christianity, but a lot of it anyway. I do find myself in agreement with him. And he still writes for the Daily Mail, and he's several books out. He's a fairly prolific author as well. That's Peter Hitchens. His brother was the late Christopher Hitchens, who was, you know, militant atheist. So it would have been, apparently they just didn't get on. They didn't, you know, but it's kind of strange that you get two brothers like that. They're both successful, well, both famous, and at such, you know, opposing ends of the scale. There's a good quote in this. He said, revolutionaries are not, he said, atheism is not inherently revolutionary, but revolutionary is inherently, you know, atheist. And of course, his brother was into, you know, communist, Marxist, and Leninist ideas, and was a militant atheist. I never found him to be a particularly impressive speaker. His brother, way more so. And his brother obviously has more of the truth on his side. So that's Peter Hitchens. I'll play some of that today. And I'll try and keep the commentary to a minimum because it's about an hour long, but I'll pick it up, say, we'll play 20 minutes of it or something like that, see how we go. Because he does cover a lot of poignant and sort of just really imperative points. And he's a very astute observer and writer. So it's worth listening to some of Peter Hitchens. In fact, I might get that new book he's got coming out. What was it called? It's called The Abolition of Britain, I think. Also, if you want to call in, I'm always delighted to hear from you. I'm in the UK, so the number is 020-3514-1993. We're here on Uber Conference. So if you want to call in, that's 020-3514-1993 or 1993. So if you're in the US and you want to call the UK, or if you're outside of the UK, you have to enter the international prefix, which is 44 for the UK. Wait for the prompt and then enter the call-in number, which is 020-3514-1993, and then press the hash key. So let's enter the international code, which is 44 for the UK. Wait for the prompt. Enter the number 020.
Actually, Paul, I'm under the impression it's the same call-in number, and that whole string of numbers is supposed to be an exit code for the UK.
So what should they be calling then, Richard?
I believe it should be 855-492-6049. And
okay, so there's no separate number for the UK then, no?
well, what I have is a list of exit codes for different countries. I have the UK as well as a lot of other countries' exit codes, and they're rather lengthy, the ones that Uber Conference supplied there. But I mean, if there's a shorter exit code you know of that'll work for your country, you'll probably be able to get by with just that, and then
So if someone wants to call me in the UK tonight on the show, what do they need to do?
Well, they would want the exit code for the UK, which I believe is 020-3514.
Yeah, 0-0-0-0-0-0-0-0-0-0-0-0-0-0-0-0-0-0-0-0-0-0-0-0-0-0-0-0-0-0-0-0-0-0-0-0-0-0-0-0-0-0-0-0-0-0-0-0-0-0-0-0-0-0-0-0-0-0-0-0-0-0-0-0-0-0-0-0-0-0-0-0-0-0-0-0-0-0-0-0-0-0-0-0-0-0-0-0-0-0-0-0-0-0-0-0-0-0-0-0-0-0-0-0-0-0-0-0-0-0-0-0-0-0-0-0-0-0-0-0-0-0-0-0-0-0-0-0-0-0-0-0-0-0-0-0-0-0-0-0-0-0-0-0-0-0-0-0-0-0-0-0-0-0-0-0-0-0-0-0-0-0-0-0-0-0-0-0-0-0-0-0-0-0-0-0-0-0-0-0-0-0-0-0-0-0-0-0-0-0-0-0- want to call the UK from outside of the UK, you need to call the international prefix, which is 44.
Well, no, the number they're calling to speak to you on the show, that'll be the American number. And that will be the 855.
Oh, I see.
Yeah, because the Uber conference that connects you, that's going through, connected to this American number, 855-492-6049.
Right, so all they need to do is dial 855-492-6049.
Yes, sir.
Okay, all right, great. So that's, if you want to call in, that's even more straightforward. 855-492-6049. Be glad to hear from you. Any comments or questions or whatever. It's always good to interact. In the meantime, I will play Peter Hitchens. As I say, he's a journalist and an author, and I agree with the guy on a lot. I mean, as I say, he's a very insightful and eloquent writer and commentator. He, I think his book is called, what was it I said earlier? It's called The Abolition of Britain, I think he said. He's a lot older than I am, so he remembers this country in even better days before my time. And it's an interview he did on Burning Questions, which is by a Sun journalist, the Sun newspaper over here.
If you've been in a British university in the late 1960s or in the 1970s, you've absorbed all kinds of ideas about sexual morals, in many cases about drugs, though our lot didn't do much in the way of drugs. That tended to be the international Marxist group. And about personal responsibility, life in general, which you carried on into your life. And for a lot of people, for the initial few years when they plunged into the cold water of daily life and earning a living, this has been pretty hard going because they've been surrounded by adults who had been brought up in a a different age and didn't share their views, but bit by bit people worked their way up in organizations. They worked their way up in law firms and barristers' chambers and in the civil service and in the schools that they work for. They become more important, and I reckon that the morals and cultural and social opinions which we'd all developed in our universities in the late 60s and 1970s then became the currency of those places. That's how the Cultural Revolution took place, the long march to the institutions.
When you were a child, as you said, you sort of had these ideals of Britain that were torn down throughout your life. And then you turned to communism.
Trotskyism. Let's make a distinction.
Okay. Well, you turned to Trotskyism and you again, and correct me if I'm wrong, had these new ideals that you were brought up in your mind.
They were substitute ideals. I'd been brought up with a worldview. I'd been brought up with a British patriotic and Christian worldview, which collapsed before my eyes. And then I found another one, which was that of revolutionary socialism.
So what was it that collapsed that next phase?
Oh, it didn't work. I went out to work in the cold, grey world, and I'm very lucky in that I went to work in newspaper journalism. And it confronted me very, very quickly with the practical impossibility of the things which I'd believed in, and it forced me to live not as a sort of visitor. I couldn't stay in London, for instance, or live in London. I had to live out in the provinces, in the true drama of provincial life. I had to deal with police officers and firemen and Tory councillors and people of that kind who I. The simple views of ideology were wrong, and that also the way of life which I've been living in my sequestered, subsidized university campus were not true. So bit by bit, I abandoned it.
And then you
through
became
a process of simple of reason and experience, which is really the only way in which anybody ever gets anywhere. And it took me a very long time to get from there to where I am now, because for a long time I really didn't know what to think. And I tried the Labour Party, for instance, and that didn't work out. I even tried the Conservative Party for a brief while, and then I understood the total futility of that. It wasn't even a political activity. I don't think there is any politics in the Conservative Party, but I did. I tried the Labour Party, and then eventually I realised what I was what I am now, but it took a while.
After your period of Trotskyism, you became a journalist.
I did stints on the Old Socialist Worker. So it was something I'd already decided I wanted to do, but I originally set out in journalism to subvert the nation. I thought that I would become a journalist, work my way into journalism, and use my position to pursue the Marxist-Leninist cause. It didn't work out that way.
And as you said earlier, you were a journalist through Thatcher's government, is that right?
Yes, I was. I first of all did 3 years on the Swindon Evening Advertiser, a brief stint on the Coventry paper. Then I was first of all a general reporter, probably the worst there ever was, on the Daily Express. Then I became an education reporter for a while. Then I did industrial journalism, which was the kind of elite core of Fleet Street at the time, because there was almost nothing going on but endless strikes and industrial crises. And this group, this very tight-knit group, as it turned out, as I discovered, in many cases, very left-wing people on all the papers. I worked for the Daily Express, but most of my drinking time and my talking time and my any time inside and outside the office between breakfast and staggering home very late at night was spent with the other correspondents. We were a very tight knit group. We looked after each other, and it was a very intense experience. And we also got to know again the people we were dealing with were trade union officials, many of whom were extremely impressive people. Not all, but many who worked their way up from extremely unpromising beginnings to become people of importance and responsibility, and were very educational to know, and often very pleasant to know as well. So that was a world in which I lived. I fell out with the others because I didn't think like them, that the left's more or less triumphalist takeover of several unions and its belief that you could constantly gain what you wanted by strikes and disruption was true. I always remember my great act of betrayal when I went to go down to the old engineering union, and they would go and sit in a particular pub with the left-wing members of the executive. And I tired of it, so I went instead to the Peckham Liberal Club, where the right-wing members of the executive were. And this was reported back to the other industrial correspondents, and I began to become unpopular for doing that kind of thing. And that's one of the points which I turned.
After this period, I know that it sort of, it was 1990 to 92, you were out in Moscow.
Yeah, well, that was a there was a long gap between. Yeah, but I spent quite a lot of time in Eastern Europe in the Warsaw Pact countries between the sort of late '80s and 1990. Then I did go to Moscow in 1990, much later than I would have liked to have done, but I got there just in time.
And you managed to sort of experience the last breaths of communism.
I arrived when I arrived. The country was the Soviet Union. When I left, it was Russia.
And as you said, you were even in the Eastern Bloc countries for some time. Is that
right? Yeah, I did quite a lot of. I became fascinated with them. I first went to visit the Eastern European countries in the late '70s, and I went to Poland in 1980 during the first Solidarity strikes in Gdansk, and met the great privilege my Lech Wałęsa. So I'd already got the bug. I thought it was the most fascinating part of the world. Well, I was amazed more people weren't interested in it, and that's how I got to Moscow by this sustained interest.
Can you talk a little bit about how communism, or let's say some Marxist ideals, have penetrated various aspects of British life? Now, I know that some people would accuse you of sort of being a conspiracy theorist with that, but can you just explain to people, sort of layman's terms, how that has worked and how that's developed?
Well, people misunderstand what the revolutionary movement has become. When Antonio Gramsci, the great Italian communist thinker, went to the Soviet Union in the early 1920s, he realized immediately it was a failure, as any intelligent man. And most of the intelligent thinking in the revolutionary movement has been done in Italy, which is also later on became the origin of the Euro-communist movement. What people such as Gramsci recognized was that the Soviet Union, the Leninist coup d'etat, was a mistake, that if you were going to obtain left-wing rule in advanced Christian Western European countries, you had to have a different approach. Basically, his approach was cultural revolution. And it's been summed up, he didn't use this phrase, it's been summed up as the long march of the institutions, a chain.
Essentially, what we call cultural Marxism, or say, you know, also known as political correctness. This is how communism and Marxist ideologies are manifest in the West today. And they are not welcomed, and they are diametrically opposed to Christianity. Christianity is anathema to them. So they've had to sort of do it incrementally and perniciously over a century to prepare the soil. Or as Henry Ford said, you secularize the public schools and subsequently the nation, and then fill the void full of Jewish revolutionary ideas like socialism, communism, feminism, all the isms, multiculturalism, etc., etc., ad nauseam.
You're not trying to capture the barracks and the post office and the railway station and advance on the Winter Palace wearing fur hats and carrying bayonets. What?
Capture being a very good word, and I really think this is why I played this piece. This really does encapsulate this movement, this nefarious, pernicious, satanic movement that has gripped the West today.
You capture is the television studio and the comprehensive school and the university and the law office and the courtroom.
And of course, capture our politicians as well.
And you also capture everything. You capture literature and the way it's taught. You capture history as well. And the other thing which also you capture is sexual relations and the way in which men and women live their private lives, if they have private lives at all, and the morality which governs them. And you are ultimately, you're bound to be atheist, because the utopian idea of revolution involves the changing of human beings into something else. And the most fundamental precept of the Christian religion is that man is made in the image of God, and therefore it is not to be changed. And so that's why there's this fundamental hostility. No true revolutionary can be a Christian believer. Atheism isn't universally revolutionary. Revolutionary is a university atheist, and that's where it grates, and you often hear it grating on that issue. My late brother, for instance, remained revolutionary on that to the end of his days. He couldn't stand religion because he was ultimately a worldly utopian. So all those things And it doesn't need violent clashes, and it doesn't need bayonets, and it doesn't need armored cars, and it doesn't need barricades, and it's done by salami slicing here and there, by simply moving into places, by becoming the predominant person, by bodies such as the Supreme Court. You won't find on the Supreme Court anybody who has any socially or morally conservative ideas, as far as I can see. They're not there, because the legal profession has, particularly since the Blair Revolution, the Judicial Appointments Commission, has become almost universally politically liberal. But these ideas are not the ideas of Lenin and the Soviet Union: nationalize the chewing gum industry, nationalize the steel industry, nationalize everything. They don't care about that. They're perfectly prepared to live alongside a quite ferocious capitalism, as happens with the Communist Party in China. There's more of them. What they're concerned about is the culture. What this is basically, it's not a repeat of 1917 in the Soviet Union. It's a repeat of 1789 and the social, moral, cultural, religious revolution of the Jacobins, which Marx always admired and which he really based his thoughts on and which enthused him more than anything else. That revolution was stopped in its tracks by Bonaparte. And France has never fully recovered from it, but it has to a great extent recovered from it. But what that revolution wanted, the utter transformation of society and mankind that revolution wanted, was more or less put to one side for, I suppose, 200 years. But the collapse of the Soviet Union meant that the old seed spores of it found somewhere to grow again, and they have been growing. And a lot of people find this very attractive. They see a liberation and they want it, but don't expect them to look like Lenin or Trotsky or even Clement Attlee. It's not like that anymore. Revolution is about different things. Sex, drugs, and rock and roll, that's what the revolution is about.
Let's talk about some of those things, sex, drugs, and rock and roll. I love that. Drugs, you've got your huge, huge campaign against drugs.
It's a very small campaign. The other side has a huge campaign.
What I mean is it's something that's very important to you.
It's hugely important because it's a mistake which we're about to make, which is avoidable. And you stand there shouting. The boy stood on the burning deck. For goodness sake, can you not see the terrible mistake which you would be making by legalizing another dangerous poison alongside cigarettes and alcohol in our society? Have these things not done enough harm that you now want to legalize marijuana? And the evidence is all on my side. And the correlation between marijuana use and mental illness is startling. The increasing correlation between marijuana use and serious criminal violence seems to me to demand a proper judge-led inquiry with the power to demand evidence, because it's so there is so much of it. The website Attacker Smoke Cannabis, which is compiled by a friend of mine, he just goes through all the local newspaper reports and finds every single case of violence where marijuana is involved, is astonishing, and it's in what it shows. But the amazing public relations of the legalization campaign has managed to persuade an awful lot of people, for instance, that marijuana is some sort of medicine. And that it's really something that's good for you. And this, of course, these awful cases of these tragic children whose mothers believe that some form of marijuana has helped their children, who even with a heart of stone can resist a plea of that kind and not be influenced by it. And people are influenced by it. It doesn't actually alter the fact.
So what we're looking at basically is just lawlessness, as the scriptures would call it. Just lawlessness. And if you have a Christian worldview in your head, you can see that these things are satanic. They are humanity hating and humanity destroying. And these haughty fools who promoted these guys who call themselves progressive, well, the jury's out whether it's progressive, looking at the decline of the West in terms of crime, in terms of what they call mental health, which is nothing more than moral decisions, which, as Peter's about to go on here to outline, has been rebranded in the judicial system as to your background and what are the reasons for criminality, rather than accepting what they have been for centuries under Christian culture. Basically, the immoral choices that an individual or people make, which then is punishable. Rather than now, we have to look at certain communities, particularly the black community. And I'm not saying this to single out the black community, but it epitomizes what I'm saying when it comes to crime. There's always some excuse for the black community, rather than, well, no, it's just their behavior needs to change. And of course, you've got single mothers. In our society is an increasingly phenomenon today. When you get men out of the way, and then you get women making too many of their own decisions, in my opinion, because I just don't think God created women to do too much thinking in terms of, what's best for their family and what are they, and making big decisions on things. They may want to, and many of them are very willful, but it doesn't mean that they're going to be good decisions. And I think the launching of women into the political and cultural arena has been a disaster, even for well-meaning women. Many of them are well-meaning. But the Bible affirms that the man is the head of the household for a reason. And so, in other words, he has the most important role in a family. So you can, it's not hard to imagine that it's the damage and the destruction that's caused when there is no man there and the woman is making all the decisions. They are easily deceived. It was Satan deliberately targeted Eve in the garden, whether you take that as a literal story or a symbolic metaphor to get a point across. Adam wasn't in the picture. He deliberately targeted Eve, and he had deliberately targeted her sense of, perhaps her sense of injustice at the one thing she couldn't have. Did God really say you can't have that? You see it all the time. Women want their so-called liberation with everything. It's why it's so easy to appeal to them. Satan put the idea in her head. Did God say you can't eat of that, the tree of good and evil? It's good to eat. Go and eat it. Why should you be kept down like this? Why don't let it, why should you be have this held back from you? Go and eat it. There's an injustice here. And this is what King Solomon said, there is nothing new that's under the sun. This is exactly what feminism is. It's basically women being targeted again by Satan through their human agents, appealing to their same sense of pride, for their sense of increased status and extra privileges that they think they're having. And it's not how they were created, but they are more pliable and they are more easily deceived, in my opinion, because I don't think God created them to be making big decisions about everything which affect the nation, its culture, society. And anyway, I digress, but single mothers are a big problem in our culture, and that has been engineered as well in many ways through the eradication of morality in the West and the disrespect that the judicial system and disregard that it holds for the promises of marriage, for example. So you get a lot of broken families and children being brought up without fathers. It does not produce a good society, and I do not believe that that is progress. It doesn't matter how much they want to hijack the language and insinuate that by their calling themselves progressives, that somehow with each year that goes by, things are automatically getting better. No, things are changing. It's not progress. The society and time will decide whether it's a good change or not. And obviously, like Peter Hitchens here, I agree that these changes have been nothing short of disastrous for the country or for the West in general.
Marijuana is a terrible drug, and particularly when used by the young, can destroy not merely their lives, but the lives of their families who are then looking after the irrevocably changed person as a result. It's a terribly dangerous drug. So I fight. Whenever I get the opportunity, I fight against its legalization in the hope that it can be prevented. But look, I'm trying to prevent a change here. I'm not trying to make one.
The sweeping changes of our society that you threw. Now, Tony Blair, he was this fantastic example that you used to first kind of open people's eyes to this, right? So Tony Blair's cabinet.
Blair himself, I met him before he was famous. I think he's Olympically dim. I don't think he understood very much of what it was his government was doing. We had people around him who understood. He was chosen by the Labour Party as the anti-Michael Foot. He didn't look like him, he didn't sound like him, and people didn't think he was like him. He was a reassuring figurehead to stick on basically a pirate ship. I've never thought that he really grasped very much of what he was doing.
And what did he do when he came to power? What did he do to sort of change?
There were so many things that happened when they won the election. There was the constitutional part, which a lot of people forget. The extraordinary, more or less, putsch, where orders in council were passed, which allowed Alistair Campbell and Jonathan Powell, although they had no elected office, to give orders to civil servants. So basically, you had two political commissars installed at the heart of the civil service, who were able to politicize it, which it has been politicized ever since. And that was a grave blow at the constitution. There was the attack on the old semi-hereditary House of Lords, which had its faults, but was still a break on government and had many people in it who were independent of government, which was also a delayed action attack on monarchy because it was an attack on the hereditary principle. And if that's wrong, then how can you sustain the idea of monarchy? So there were those changes, which people have not fully understood. With things like the Judicial Appointments Commission, where the nature of the way in which judges were appointed and the sort of things that they were expected to be.
Another thing, of course, is the change in the marriage law. In terms of, you know, before, marriage was basically something that reflected, it was born out of, certainly for the most part, I'm not saying marriage didn't exist before, but in Western culture, marriage was basically something that was conducted through the ethics and the standards of Christianity and had a, you know, origin from that. This has now been, and it has always been between a man and a woman. It's been now, the state has now, under this new system, decided it's between a man and a man, a woman and a woman, and God knows whatever else someone wants to feel that they should be entitled to get married to. We have this phenomenon of relativism, which means there is no basic reality. If I want to identify as a horse, then who are you to tell me I'm not? You're infringing on my civil liberties here. Of course, the double standard of that is incredible, as we live in a police state and we have less liberty now than we ever had. We have the change of the law in divorce, where now there is no need for any real good reason for a divorce now. It's just if you want to terminate marriage, you can do that. So they've just made a mockery of marriage. That's another way in which they've undermined society in a major way as well. And departed from Christianity in those things, those really important matters for a culture.
Do altered. There was the absolute. If people go on and on about Clause 4, who cares about Clause 4? The Labour Party had given up nationalising things years ago. It wasn't an issue. The real Clause 4 of the Labour Party was its absolute obsession with egalitarianism before education. There's a comprehensive schools, a political project to reach an egalitarian end, and if education suffers as a result, the man who invented them, Graham Savage, admitted this: education suffers as a result. Well, that's a pity, but the point of them is egalitarian, and the Labour Party passed into law provisions which mean it became illegal to open a British state school which was academically slanted. Education was the absolute, read my lips, we will never switch away from policy of Labour, and that was the core of it, one which they ultimately forced the Conservative Party to adopt as well. And that was crucial. The general sort of assault on old-fashioned morality, the general adoption of political correctness, of diversity and equality as the official state religion, was partly driven, I think.
And it is a religion. It has all the basic aspects of in place like a religion does. It has the doctrines of inclusivity, diversities or strength, multiculturalism, the intolerance of intolerance, of course, insane levels of egalitarianism, and it has the priesthood, most of them which are celebrity type figures, and it has its consistencies with how it treats dissenters. They get treated like heretics, and they can't burn you at the stake, but they will affect your relationships, your income, your jobs, your reputation, your safety. You might end up in prison if you say the wrong thing, like Jez Turner has said. So free speech is not tolerated in a way like the most oppressive religions deal with free speech. So it has many of the tenets of a religion. And I very much agree with that. In fact, I'm hearing more and more people refer to political correctness as a religion. I heard Douglas Murray talking about it recently as well, the guy who wrote the book, The Strange Death of Europe.
Legislation which came from Brussels. Brussels, but also was enthusiastically adopted by them. It's now the case, for instance, because of the Equality Act, which is a hugely important act, the Equality Act, I think of 2010, it's now the case, for instance, that all religions are equal, which means, of course, that the former position of Christianity as the official religion of the country, the basis of the coronation service, the basis of the constitution, the basis...
And that is massive, because the reality is not all religions are equal. They're not all the same. And they don't all have truth. They make contradicting claims, so they can't, by the sheer nature of truth, they can't both be true, they can't all be true, if they make opposing claims. You know, Islam and Christianity make different claims, just even on the issue of Jesus. Which one's true? Because they can't both be true. Jesus can't just be a prophet and also actually God in the flesh and the ultimate deity that Christians worship. And at the same time, be an important, albeit second to Muhammad, as a prophet. The two things can work. So this idea, this idea that he's talking about, where all religions are the same in egalitarianism, completely negates essentially what is true to determine its prominence. And this is, and again, you're back to how nations formed. The Western European nations and the Northern European nations largely formed because they affirmed that Christianity was true. That made those nations and their culture different from Middle Eastern countries, which largely affirmed that Islam is true. But now you have, because of mass immigration, you have them all together. It's amazing that there isn't more tensions than there actually is, considering that you put all these things together and then you've got the Jewish media stoking up the tensions. And I also find it really fascinating that, there really is nothing new that's under the sun, because when you read the book of Acts, you will see that the Jews were doing exactly that. If they weren't directly persecuting the Christians, they were. You see the phrase in the book of Acts several times, they were stoking up the people. They stoked up the tensions, and they used their influence with any non-Jewish figures that they could do in positions of power to persecute the Christians and to engineer things they wanted to do. And they stoked up tensions in the people for their own utterly, utterly outright self-centered needs. And so much of this is just, notwithstanding that we have a lot of fools that are responsible for buying into all this stuff, and many, many gladly reject Christianity because of what it does and because of how it produces a better society, because people are accountable in their minds to a higher authority that they will one day face. You remove that and you immediately are, by the nature of man, you're going to unleash lawlessness, because man, it doesn't have any accountability. If he can get away with it. And eventually you end up with a society that becomes a much lower trust society, and it doesn't improve it for anybody. This idea that, all religions are the same, they are not all the same. And the veracity of the claims they make has to be established on proper grounds for their prominence. It's irritating that it's all this egalitarian thing just affirms, oh, we're all the same. Even within Christianity, as I said earlier, people say, they try and merge it with this egalitarianism idea. Well, doesn't God treat everybody fairly and justly? Doesn't God treat everybody, aren't we all the same in God's eyes? Well, God does treat everybody fairly and justly, but he doesn't treat everybody the same. He doesn't treat criminals the same. He doesn't treat believers and non-believers alike. He might love everybody, but he doesn't treat everybody the same. Egalitarianism attempts to strive for that, and it does not work. It, in its very essence, it is outside the matrix of actual reality, because the idea of relativism is not interested in
reality.
Technically and legally, so that ultimately equality and diversity trumpet. So the Christian religion is just one of many religions competing for attention on the same basis as others. That's what equality means in this case. That's a huge revolution. And there were so many of these things. They took up a 1980s, which the Conservatives have only begun doing, such as fake prison sentences to empty the prisons. They inherited a police and criminal justice system which has already been eviscerated and continue to eviscerate it in the same way, and they continue to undermine the idea of personal responsibility in the way in which basically crime was the slogan, tough on crime, tough on the causes of crime. It did not mean what people thought it meant. They weren't actually tough on crime. But what they meant by causes of crime was what all left-wingers believe, that crime is caused by poverty
You know, I wonder, do all left-wingers believe it? I just think a lot of them don't care. I think some of them are deceived into believing it. I think a lot of them are just more interested in power-grabbing. And these ideologies, well, I think it's debatable whether they even believe them themselves. As long as they're not affected by the negative consequences of them, I don't think they really care that much.
And child abuse and all kinds of psychological pressures on people. And basically, when crimes...
In other words, they're utter hypocrites, which we see being proven over and over again.
The person who commits the crime is an offender. Is basically doing it as a result of the conditions in which he or she lives. And so, for the left, crime is just another reason to spend more money, which, of course, they also did. There was a huge revolution in public spending under Gordon Brown shortly after the New Labour took office. They abandoned their pledges to keep spending low, and they went on the most gigantic spending spree, which we're still paying for. So there's that, too. But the tough on the causes of crime actually meant that we will more and more adopt the view that crime is a disease caused by social conditions rather than the action of a responsible person who can be punished for it. So that entered into the whole, fully into the whole attitude.
These things at the time, you know, Isaiah says, woe to those who call good evil and evil good. And you can see how these things are presented and seen as good. Oh, it's your conditions, you know. Have you got the education? You know, have you got the same opportunities? This is what we hear all the time. And it doesn't matter how much increase we have in black crime. The black community never are told to take responsibility for it. Just, for example, that community, because they do produce so much crime. Instead, they will talk about the opportunities that they lack, et cetera, et cetera. And when it's pointed out to them that they've got the same, you know, opportunities as any other immigrants who are, many of them, thriving, Indians, Chinese, et cetera, then they still resort to blaming white men and white people for, you know, institutional racism, which is basically racism but doesn't need any evidence for it. And this is why you're hearing this, all this stuff in this woke culture, which is just political correctness on steroids, it's a subconscious bias that we're exhibiting. So you're now responsible for what you don't even know you're doing, you see. And this, of course, comes straight out of the Jewish writings of the authoritarian personality. But when you point out that there's no evidence for racism, then it's a subconscious bias. When you point out that the blacks have the same opportunities as everybody else, then they'll sort of double down and say, no, they don't, and it's a subconscious bias by white people. And so it's almost like the more crime there is, the more guilty white people are, because it's like the root cause of it is basically oppression and lack of opportunity by white people. It rarely gets to the point where you ever hear any of these political correct mouthpieces on mainstream media ever condemn the black community for being responsible for their own communities. I mean, you just get lectured all the time, insulted all the time, being called racist, and lectured all the time about, you know, Black Lives Matter. Well, apparently, you know, instead of lecturing, instead of the black community and mainstream media lecturing the rest of us about Black Lives Matter, why don't they go and tell their own communities? Because apparently they don't know, because the majority of the crime is on black communities, on their own people, on all our black people. And I don't take any joy in that. I've got nothing against black people at all. Not at all. I find some of them quite colorful. I'm just using that as an example of this lack of responsibility, this reframing, you know, tough on crime and tough on the reasons of crime. We don't need to rebrand what crime is. Crime has always been successfully diagnosed in any real Christian society living in a reality as a choice, a moral choice that someone makes. You cannot use your background and your circumstances, or your lack of jobs or lack of money, as some sort of justification for going out and stabbing someone or robbing someone. That is a choice you make. No one's forced you to do it. But this is how this narrative plays out. It's like you've suddenly lost your free will and your choice in the matter. If you're bored, you must go out and rob an old lady. Well, why not go and help an old lady? Why not read a book or something? But anyway, that's the society we now live in. And you can see that it's a softy approach to a lot of things. Again, you have that emotional nature of women being launched into the political arena and the cultural arena, which likes to soften things up a little bit and look at all, you know, make excuses. And unfortunately, it doesn't create a very prosperous, safe, or thriving society in reality.
And as a result, they don't actually achieve anything.
Sort of the taking away of responsibility.
Well, that's been going for a long time, but they put the caps in. Like, what had been happening in British society for many years since the 1960s had been that these ideas had been becoming more and more common among civil servants and senior police officers and people of this kind, and academics in criminology, but they had not been put into legal effect by a government. And one of the reasons why there was such a hunger and almost a fury among the left in 1997 was that they had long ago felt that they'd won the Cultural Revolution in the institutions, but somehow or other they hadn't had a government ever to match. This is also one of the reasons for the great howl of pain when they lost the election in 1992. They had thought they were on the verge of getting a government which matched the long march of the institutions, and then they didn't get it. In 1997, they got it. And so there was this ghastly new dawn moment when left-wing people all thought that the world had begun again, and it was the year zero.
Now, you've been writing about this for 20 years now.
Yeah, it feels like longer.
But it's interesting, in the last couple of years, or maybe the last few years, we've seen the rise of the woke movement, but also the anti-woke movement. Now, what I mean by that is, you know, you've got these people like Jordan Peterson coming out and saying you know, similar things to what you were saying 20 years ago.
I don't think Jordan Peterson has anything that has been saying anything particularly similar.
And I don't think this whole fuss about Jordan is justified either. I mean, I've listened to a few of these guy quotes. I mean, yeah, I agree with some of the stuff, but yeah, he's not that impressive. I don't know how this guy's been has gained so much fame and success. I mean, he's not that impressive.
In a sense, you know, he's sort of talking about the change of our institutions, our sort of cultural institutions to become.
Jordan Peterson is a cult. I don't. Mm. I mean, he was courageous in standing up against thought policing in Canada in one instance, but in general, I don't see in his writings anything remotely conservative in reality.
But you have.
I was asked to review his latest book, and I never review a book unless I read it from cover to cover, which sometimes is more of a struggle than others. I have to tell you, reading Jordan Peterson was not fun, but I have read it, and he's not my ally.
Well, let's take him as an example, but I think there's been a few of these kind of instances in the media. Let's say Lawrence Fox, for example, you know, people fighting against what they say.
Again, this guy Lawrence Fox has come out and, you know, said a few sort of things that I think the reason I find it annoying is because, I mean, it's such a big deal of the guy. And he isn't saying anything that shows like this and other shows around the internet and alternative media have been saying for years.
There's PC, what they see is diversity, what they see is people of authoritarianism.
It's coherent. It's not. I mean, someone stands up and says what Lawrence Fox says on Question Time and everything. But it doesn't amount to anything. It's just a brief festival of the oppressed in which people say, oh, somewhere. But it's not a real, it's not the rebirth of conservatism in the human mind. It's not people saying, how would we, in a civilized fashion, set out to reverse changes for the bad which have happened in our country? How would we go, as I've been trying to do since 1999, go to the intelligent, thoughtful people on the left and say to them, look, even by your own standards, this has been a mistake. It's not worked on its own terms. We must do something about it. That's what I want to do. Making brief protests of that kind is of no value and does nothing for me at all.
Do you think people are at least opening their eyes a little bit to what you see, obviously?
I have no sense that they are, no. Mm. No, I think people occasionally do feel that there are moments where they suddenly feel constrained. As when Blair made his Forces of Conservatism speech, a lot of people suddenly realised what he was. It had almost no impact on me because I already knew. And I was quite surprised to see people saying, good heavens, so that's what he means. I'd known all along, and this is a problem I have. When people catch up with me, I tend not to say, oh joy, that you've caught up with me. But where have you been all this time? It's irritating that when I needed you, you weren't there. My own view is that everything was irrevocably lost in 2010, so I don't see any political hope anyway.
Thank you very much, Pete Hitchens.
All right, that was journalist and author Peter Hitchens. I think his book is called The Abolition of Britain, his newest book. And, he kind of encapsulated a lot of the themes that I've been talking about on this show and my other show on Revolution Radio at freedomslips.com. If you ever want to tune in there, that's 9 p.m. to 10 p.m. just before this show. That's 4 till 5 Eastern time. It's Revolution Radio at freedomslips.com. And since I've done this show, I mean, I've been sort of hammering away at promoting Christianity and the consequences of that, of Christianity being removed from the culture. Obviously, the nefarious, pernicious damage that that the increase in Jewish influence and in our culture, the overreaching and destructive arm of Jewish power and influence in the West, and so and their religion of political correctness, cultural Marxism that they bring with them, among other things. So, yeah, I thought it was worthy of playing that clip. As I say, sort of captures a lot of the themes that I've been talking about myself for the last 3 or 4 years. All right, I'll be back. Thank you for joining me tonight, and I will be back again next Thursday, the 13th, I believe, of February, and same time, 10 p.m. till 11 p.m. here in the UK, 5 p.m. till 6 p.m. Eastern Standard Time. Until then, stay safe and God bless you.